don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Radio 1 listeners, how are we doing? It's that time of the summer again. A brand new series of Second Captain starts right here, and we'll be with you every Saturday for the next couple of months. So I'm at Devitt with Kieran Murphy. Hey, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Now, last year, Conan O'Brien, Rady Pete, Irvin Welsh, Annie Mack, and Michael Sheen were among the latest crop of superstar guests to join us to talk about their remarkable careers and stories, while also competing against each other for the honour of being crowned Second Captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson. A title that surely means nothing to these super impressive people who've done it all in their careers, right?
Yeah!
How about it, Michael?
You beauty! Wow. On the line!
Yeah, Michael Sheen there, our 2023 champ. I really hope it goes the other way this season, Murph, and at least one of our guests gets legitimately angry at you. That seems like the logical next twist.
Well, see, no one's actually discovered that I fold like a cheap tent anytime any of the guests rebuke me. So maybe this is the year I get rumbled. You know, I give someone points to hold, and they just go right ahead and say, no, I want 10 more points.
Oh, that'd work for sure. We start the new series in the class of 2024 in real style today. First up, to lay down a marker, is someone with true national treasure status. It's been a massive part of Irish cultural life over the last 30 years. Brendan Gleeson is in studio today. Do you need me to read out the man's IMDb page? Braveheart, Michael Collins in Bruges, Gangs of New York. He's got an Oscar nomination for The Banshees of Inisherin, an Emmy Award for his portrayal of Winston Churchill in Into the Storm. And that's barely scratching the surface of one of the great careers of any Irish actor. I think you got the same reaction as me, Murph, when you told people who he had on for our first show of the series. I talked to a few people and they're like, oh, wow. What time's that on? Always what you want to hear when you're telling somebody about a show coming up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And is there a more interesting, expressive face in Irish cinema as well? We're incredibly excited, as you can possibly tell.
I believe this is also the first time a father and son have competed on the show. We had Breen Gleeson on a previous series. How did his sporting career measure up?
Well, listen on, Breen was a great little trier, a great little goer. But the impression that he himself left us with was one of 100% pure effort, mixed with, shall we say, modest ability. I think that's a kind way of putting it.
74 points, I think he ended up with. Was that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
Can Brendan crush that target? Can he crush the sporting dreams of his own son in front of the nation? We are about to find out. Murph, before we welcome the man to the studio, for our Radio 1 listeners who might not be familiar with the show, please explain the very strict rules of this sporting life.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Yeah, on a quick refresher course is perhaps in order here. To be crowned Ireland's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2024, they must answer me these challenges three. I will assess each contestant on their sporting achievements. I will assign to them a sports star that I feel most closely resembles them. And then, having considered their all-time sporting highlight, I will give them a score out of 100. They're going to go up against seven other guests in this series, and the top point scorer this season will be crowned the champion. And I think it's important to note that the guests who know the least about sport are often our favourites. So you need know nothing about sport to be a guest or indeed be a listener to this show. You've already mentioned last year's winner was Hollywood superstar Michael Sheen on 87 points. He had trials with Arsenal after all. And in previous years, we've had your Malcolm Gladwells, your Aisling Bees, your Dorothy Crosses of this world come out on top. Anything over 80's got a chance. Anything over 85... and you can start ordering the tuxedo / ball gown.
Well, our first guest of a brand new series of Second Captain Saturday is one of the most beloved Irish actors of all time. But Emmy Awards and Oscar nominations count for nothing in the pressure cooker he has voluntarily walked into today. Brendan Gleeson, thank you so much for coming into studio. Are you ready to take your son down a peg or two? I mean, that's what good parenting is all about, after all.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm up to it.
You're just going to look into your soul now, and just from the deepest recesses.
I feel tremulous. Like 74 is a bit of a reach.
It's solid. You know, it's I would call it a solid score. I don't think it's, you know, it's intimidatingly high.
To be fair, though, we
haven't had our chat yet.
Yes, that is true.
And I should say, Murph, Brendan loses points straight away on the basis of a painful childhood memory that Brian brought to our attention surrounding the 1994 Coca-Cola Cup final, when poor little Brian was supporting Manchester United and was reduced to tears as his Aston Villa supporting father lorded it over him after a 3-1 win.
Yeah, I roared. Oh. I did roar at the final whistle. Mm. But it was Bon McGrath, you know what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, no, it wasn't my finest moment. his lower lip just started to go. Mm. I realised that I traumatised him. Yeah, and it was my own fault, really, because I'd kind of encouraged him to go for a team other than Villa, because Villa basically were losing a lot of matches a lot of the time, and I'd already sort of traumatised my firstborn with becoming an Aston Villa supporter.
That was Donal.
That was Donal, yeah. Donal was lumbered with that. So I kind of felt, well, maybe, you know, give the others a chance a little bit. So Ferguson Breen went for United, I think, and Rory just didn't bother. It was very funny, but it was the first time I had a bit of a history with Villa, because I'd started when I was 14. I picked out Villa out of an FA Cup draw, and I said, what are these like? And Jack Fitzpatrick said, yeah, they're good, good big tradition, they won the FA Cup 7 times. And yeah, and I'm looking at it, it's kind of cool gear, you know, they had all these little stripes on the cuffs at one time. I always remember that. Well, anyway, I said, I'll jump in with those. And that's sort of, that they became my team. And then they were, I think the following season, they were relegated to the third division.
Well, I mean, you should really thank your mate there. He absolutely sold you down the river. It's like, he won 7 FA Cups, the last of which was in 1923 or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. But, I started putting you know, things up in my bedroom wall and stuff like that, and trying to follow league positions. But I couldn't find, like, it was Goal, the magazine that used to furnish most of these little trappings. And I think when I went to the third division, there weren't really that much, there wasn't much merch for... And I used to have to twiddle around the aerial on the radio to try and get BBC Kimru to get the results even. But they came back, in fairness now, they came back. So when 94 happened and we had actually won silverware, I did lose the run of myself.
Well, it's understandable. We came across a piece that you wrote for a Dublin match programme recently. Were the Dubs a big part of your childhood?
I did, yeah. My brother, Barry, he ended up playing with Parnells, and he was a big Gaelic man. I think I wrote in that article about Solo, and he brought me to Croker, I think, I can't remember, was it 58, around there, sometime like that, and I was 3 or 4 or something. But John Timmins used to have a particular Solo, and according to Barry anyway, he used to run it up along the length of his shin. So he didn't actually just kick the ball and catch it. It kind of ran up along his shin like a yo-yo, like... and you couldn't get at it, you couldn't tackle it. So that's the reason nobody could tackle it.
It sounds anatomically impossible.
No. It's absolutely wow. Attainable. So I remember running around trying to do the John Timmins solo, and it didn't end well, really. It didn't run up my shin. But yeah, that was Barry, and he was kind of, so that was what I was kind of brought up with. But in primary school, there was a fantastic Christian brother there, and he took me in different directions in terms of he had a choir that he used to have that I used to really love singing in harmony with you know, and it'd be fairly modern songs and stuff. It wasn't religious necessarily, but and he'd have concerts on the whole time. He'd put us up. He did amazing stuff. Really enthusiastic. I found he was only 21 when he came to Marino, but he had a huge influence on me in terms of that. Kind of took my head away. So the football was, like, it was only in the background somewhere. I think I might have played with the juniors and stuff like that, but I really wasn't all that fussed.
Well, we can come back to your sporting prowess in more detail, Brendan, but when did you first realise you wanted to be a performer, or did you think of it that way, or be an actor?
So at that stage, in primary school, it was sort of something that I just loved, but I never thought about doing it. And then you go to secondary school, completely different vibe. Nobody was that interested in the arts, let's be honest. And there was a bunch of us that had come through that particular school in 6th year, became more and more interested in it, and then a few of the lads went off and started a theatre company. So that, but it was never something that I thought of doing as, it took a while, basically. I just thought it was for other people or something.
Yeah. Your mother was a bit of a performer herself. There was a warmth and a bit of divilment to her, I think you recorded as saying once upon a time.
Well, she was brilliant. She was one of those people. I always remember when she was sick and she was told she had collapsed or something, and the thing, she was, you know, blood pressure or something low. But she was told not to be any sudden movements. And I went in and I said, "How are you?" And she was sitting, you know, a bit shook looking at the table. And she started explaining what the doctor said to her. But she jumped up out of the chair to do him, to do the doctor, to be the doctor.
Yeah.
So she's one of those people. She was a brilliant sort of a mimic, but not in a bad way. She was very, she'd be kind, but she had a way of putting a cut on her, and you were absolutely looking at the person. And she used to go to plays a lot. She loved it. She had good friends from her own school, and they always used to go to plays. She used to drag my father off to a lot of things that, you know, he'd pretend to enjoy. And she used to support things, like if it was any of the local crowd. It's funny, she didn't get involved herself, but if it was any local amateur crowd, she'd be funding in, she'd be buying tickets. So she was pro-theatre in that way. She was very given to it. And I suppose that would have opened up my... I was curious about it then.
And you really pursued that curiosity throughout your 20s and early 30s. I think most people know at this stage that you were a teacher before you became a full-time actor. But outside of school, you were doing plays written by people like Roddy Doyle and Paul Mercier that would sell out venues like the Olympia for weeks on end. The Passion Machine Theatre Company in particular, that was a big part of your life. So how did you get from that point to landing a role in Braveheart, one of the biggest films of the 20th century?
By doing a play in the Gaiety. And Mel Gibson came down along and saw it, or was the casting director brought him along, and then he went to see it, yeah.
Right.
Juno the Peacock was a jet. All the local lads had been brought in for auditions, because he was coming over there. I think Michael D. Higgins had gone over and stolen Braveheart from the Scots, promising the FCA. And then...
He did. We put them to use at long last. I got a lot of respect for the FCA.
Free Poets Association, but they were absolutely amazing. The whole lot of them. They were absolutely. It was so funny. It was a brilliant coup. Like Michael D was hugely instrumental. Like I've a lot to thank Michael D for reinstituting the film board, putting in, you know, the tax breaks, just doing, engaging it, and just doing it, not talking about it, doing it. And it was totally invigorating. So yeah, he went, and then I nearly lost it.
How so?
We had a run first here, and then we were supposed to go to Chicago with it. And so he said, "Can you start?" And I said, "Yeah, well, I think I might be able to." Yeah. And he rang in the theatre. Actually, I never forget the phone call. Mel Gibson rang up, and then he said, "Right, we were starting the 1st of June or whatever it was." And I said, "Well, I might have 2 weeks. But I'll sort something out." And I went to talk to them, and they wouldn't let me out of it. And I had the choice of just saying, "Well, I'm going anyway." And I just felt that'd be a really dumb thing to do. It'd just be kind of unethical, but also not a great idea in your hometown if you want to walk again. But I didn't feel right about it doing it, so I lost the part. And I was lucky that they decided just to hang in and just switch some stuff around. But that's how it happened, yeah. I was dead lucky, really.
Yeah, and it was obviously such a huge movie and a big role for you as well. And, I mean, I suppose the obvious thing to do in a situation like that is just, okay, this has been a huge success for me, I'm going to go to Hollywood. But that's not what you decided to do. You stayed at home after Braveheart.
I stayed at home, but, like, I had 4 kids when I went full-time. So, and I kind of was wedded into... here. I've always just felt this is the spot for me, really, in terms of, I got an agent over there, I went over to LA, and fair play to Mel Gibson again, like, he brought us all over for the premiere over there, and we went out, there was this big do out in one of the big studios, and the Chieftains were playing, I always remember that. It was kind of a miraculous. I had jet lag. I didn't know what jet lag was, and I was kind of saying, I don't know, is this happening? I went around looking for agents then, and I got an agent over there in the end. Mary had dressed me up in Armani clothes. I'm not joking. We went up to Grafton Street, and she said, "Come on, you're coming in." And she put me into this collarless shirt and sort of skinny trousers. And a kind of really cool sort of a shapeless jacket. And I went over and we spent a fortune that we couldn't afford, really, just doing that. And when I went over, I wasn't getting much shrift. They reckoned, oh, that's Mel's movie. All the local talent was just that, you know what I mean? It was spear carriers. But one took me on because she said, no, you just looked as if you had something about you. And I was wearing jeans into some audition afterwards. And she said, no, you don't do that over here. I said, why not? And she said, all the executives are in jeans. She said, no. She said, it's all about, they think you only have jeans to wear if you look as if you have. She said, the reason I took you on, this is about a year later, the reason I took you on because you came in with a bit of swish about you. I said, this fella, there's a touch of something going on. Thank you, Mary. Totally, yeah. For many things. But that's, she was, it was funny because I hated the idea of judging the book by the cover my life. I used to almost deliberately
dress. Issue that.
Yeah, I hated it. But the fact is that, if this is to be a real thing, you've only so much, like, they had all their work done over there. They knew everything that I'd done. I couldn't get over it. They knew the films that I had made. They knew everything of me. I couldn't get over how much they knew about, like, they're encyclopedic over there and they do their work. So they expect you to kind of do the same.
Looking back at it in the last few days, the variety of your work has been incredible. I don't know how conscious you are each time of trying to do something different. I mean, if we take it as an example, what do you say to your agent when they come to you and they ask you to read for the part of Knuckles McGinty in Paddington 2, a prison cook who falls in love with marmalade sandwiches? What's your initial reaction to that one?
I like the sound of that. I did like the sound of that. And Terry Hayden, who just passed away this year, who I miss dearly.
Your former agent, yeah.
Great friend. We became quite friends. We were chalk and cheese now. It was just, we were very, very different. Gabriel Byrne was very funny, just talking about Terry giving out to him for wearing runners and carrying a plastic bag through the airport. Runners. But she was brilliant crack because she had a sense of humour. She's a voracious reader and she kind of got it. And we had different sensibilities. So at times, and then, you know, very much coherent in terms of at the heart and soul of something. Mm. So in terms of what we trust each other, like in a way where I can say, I just don't, like, this doesn't, this, I don't, this, and she said, yeah, no, and I get it. I liked it for this, but you're right. And then she would have got me to do Churchill. I said, I'm not playing Churchill. She said, imagine an Irish man playing Churchill. Mm-hmm. She's from Derry.
Yeah.
And she's saying, how many more are going to be asked? And like, and she made me cross the road in a lot of different kind of ways. But, sorry, what was the question? I'm wondering now.
About Paddington 2.
Oh, yeah.
And Knuckles McGinty.
Yeah, but I would have said, I like the sound of that. And then I kind of read the script and I was going, this is funny.
Yeah.
And then I watched the first one that I hadn't seen. And I thought, this is brilliant. These guys are absolutely brilliant. Like, the Paddington Bear creation in that. I could not get over it. I couldn't. And it was really, but like those lads were really, really, in terms of knowing how to work a gag and how hard they worked. Like, I remember I was chopping up something, carrots or something at one stage. And at one stage I'd played a chef. And some fella told me about how to keep your fingers out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we did about 5 takes and he said, I think there's something else we can do with the camera, just to, can you move around? So I was hoping I had got away with that one.
Yeah.
So, always for the last one, you're inclined to go, and I took half my finger off. But I remember, we still did another one.
Yeah.
I got wrapped up and we went again. But they were assiduous, Paul King, particularly in terms of like, there's a better, if we just tweak the angle that way, that's funnier.
Mm.
And working with people who raise the bar for you like that, like that was one of the best experiences of working.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Like we ask about it because it's not, you know, a serious with a capital S role, but it's also one of the most beautiful movies of the 21st century. It genuinely
is. Tell them about your reaction to it, Murph.
Well, I mean, I hadn't seen the first Paddington movie. I don't really like the idea of jumping into a series without having seen the first one. So I'm sitting down watching the second one at Christmas with my entire extended family. And I mean, we're all bawling, genuinely bawling our eyes out, you know, looking at each other and kind of laughing at each other, saying, this is absurd that we're here. And we all have the exact same emotional reaction to it. And I just kind of feel like it can be a dark place, the world, sometimes.
Yeah.
But to have something that isn't cynical, you know, that is just genuinely joyous.
Life enhancing.
Yeah. There's so much to be gotten from being cynical in the world. And this is a movie that is not even remotely cynical.
No, but it doesn't deny that the world can be harsh either, right? So you're allowed to go into, you know, Roald Dahl and people like that did that as well. It's something I always admired, where they just don't patronise children by pretending that the world is completely wall-to-wall great. Yeah. I think it's a really, you know, it's an interesting, I had a good chat with Brian actually about that, and whether, you know, whether you should allow children to experience certain, you know, hardship. There is a feeling that sometimes they get so messed up by what you expose them to. But I've always felt if you don't expose them to something like germs, you don't get a cold, you know, you don't have any immunity.
Manchester United getting beaten by Aston Villa in a cup final. That sort of thing, Brendan.
Yep.
And then there's trauma. But I'm taking the hit for that one. I was really, I roared so loud. It was just, I have a far too loud voice. Mm. But honestly, the other thing about Paddington is, I did Smurfs as well, and everybody kind of said, oh, Jesus. Like, and I, the only thing I didn't, there was an awful lot of placement and corporate stuff going on. But at the same time, I really, and what else? Well, Harry Potter was the same. I think if you don't engage in cheer, like for me, the whole Bambi thing was so formative. Yeah. I can still remember talking to my mother and my mother saying, and it's a bit like what we're talking about now, you have got to expose children to the idea of death. I'd say, why would they do that in a children's movie? I remember asking her as a kid, why would you do that in a children's movie? You know, kill off the mother. Oh, geez. Spoiler alert.
There's a statute of limitations. We're all right.
Well, you know what I mean? But why expose? Yeah. And she was really adamant about it. She said, you have to, death is a part of life. And that's it, you know. So I've always kind of felt it was a magical time for me looking at those things as a child, watching them. And I think movies have that wonderful sort of ability to turn this all into children slightly. And that's why I love a theatre as well. Because the lights go down, you're alone with your thoughts, but there's a kind of a context around, and you're allowed to be, your inner child is allowed to function. Somebody said, Pam Brighton said to me years ago, like if you take for, you were talking about plays, but just broadly, if people come into you and they hand you control of their imagination for 2 hours, that's a massive responsibility. You've got to be really conscious of what you're doing with it. And it can overstate it. But like the fact is, people are allowing you to take them on a journey. And there's something childlike about that. So I think children, I've done a few children's movies now. And I would treat them with the same seriousness. And Paul King did as well. That's why that film is so good. Like his attention to detail and the sense of riotousness and joy and exuberance and all that is there, but also that feeling you've got to be careful with this and you've got to give like other elements in there. So Knuckles for me was great crack.
You are listening to Second Captain Saturday. We're here with Brendan Gleeson. We're going to delve deep into his sporting life right after these.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
You're listening to Second Captain Saturday on RT Radio 1 with Owen Murph and Brendan Gleeson, who is in with us this week. Your son, Brian, told us a story of you having a quiet word in the car with him after he's playing a match one day, Brendan, about his tendency to bellow out instructions to his teammates. I think the advice was along the lines of just maybe look after your own role first there. So listen, all your sons have excelled in their fields. You can level with us now. Were they all a bit rubbish at sport? Come on, your kids can't be great at everything.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing fine. You know, they're doing fine.
Yeah.
Well, how can I put this? Fergus was a natural athlete, shall we say. Fergus was a natural athlete. He was just, you'd know when he was running.
Yeah.
And he played Gaelic. And he would, you know, he had a great engine. Mary's side of the family, I would say, probably the genes came from somewhere. But, like, no, he was a natural athlete. And he could do things with grace, shall we say, that none of the rest of us were particularly blessed with. Sorry, lads. But in terms of the sideline, Obviously, I was encouraging Fergus a little too much at some stage, and he came over on the way home and he said, "Dad, I like winning the ball, but I'm actually not prepared to kill for it." And he said, "Okay, that's grand. You gave it a go." And like, so there was that kind of a thing where, my mother was always talking about participation. I've had this row all my life about whether the whole thing is the Roy Keane thing. Is participation the main function of sport, or and the main joy of sport, or is winning? Does it have to be winning? And my mother bred it into me that the winning bit is you give your all if you can, but not like it's not the end of all. And this thing where nobody remembers second. And I've always thought it's a bunch of rubbish myself, but I understand at a professional level, if you're going to do it as a job, I can see why it's kind of necessary to think otherwise.
That's really interesting, because obviously Donal and Breen are doing, went on and have gone on to have very successful careers acting as a job. So whatever about you advising them on their sport, you know, and you can do that maybe at a certain remove. What has it been like for you as the father now of these guys who, for better or worse, are following this legacy, following in your footsteps? How have you found that balance in terms of lending them your expertise and your experience and allowing them to find their own way?
Well, it's like a tightrope, you know. You kind of, it's easy in the beginning because you can take and you can kind of shape, and they want to listen, and then at some stage they form their own way of doing things. And, you know, you're looking at something, and like I used to kind of help them out if I was around, just reading stuff or, you know, for whatever auditions or stuff like that. And then I found I was getting in the way, you know, and they found I was getting in the way, which is more important.
Did they tell you that?
More or less. It's okay, Dad, I'll do it my own. But it was also, I kind of found there were a couple of times where I would, like with Brian, he was like a sponge in the early years, and then he began to get very clear ideas about where he wanted to go, and I did find myself trying to help and actually bringing him further away from where he wanted to go, and I could feel it happening, and I was trying not to dig in, but my instinct and where his instinct was leading him were at loggerheads. And I've always said to work with a director that you can't stand is horrible. But to work with a director who you really like but have a different sensibility and a different instinct with is absolute hell. Because you have to subjugate up to a point, but when you feel in your core that it's wrong and stuff like that. So it never got that bad with us. Now, I think we were able to walk away, with different visions of where the scene could go and stuff like that. But it became pretty clear after a while. And it was because I'm looking at it and saying, I bet you I could fix it. But I could fix it with me. I can't fix it with them. They have to fix it a different way.
Are these projects you're working on with them, because you've worked with them a lot, or are you talking about stuff that they're doing separately?
Broadly, right across the board, right. Really, with stuff that we would kind of, in those years, like it's been a while now, because they've been looking after their own stuff. And it's just because they kind of would understand what instinct I have at this stage. And they want to do something that they don't want to be led down that way. They probably know where I'm going to go. So it's funny. We still kind of chat about stuff. And in broad terms, it's like Rory's a writer. And, you know, he says everybody wants to tell you what you should be putting in your novel, you know. Yeah. It's like...
I have a good one for you now.
Yeah. Here's one now. You can put in your book.
You like this now.
It's that exact thing.
Yeah.
And you can... So you have to try and stop doing that. But it's hard not to when you kind of think, oh, you know.
Yeah, I'm helping.
Bet you didn't think of this. And they say, no, he probably did.
I can see as well, though, watching this, the stuff that you've done with your sons, that there's a great kind of similarity in your sense of humour. So much of it can be quite absurdist and silly and off the wall and brilliant. And, you know, you see actors acting with their sons or with their fathers, and much of it can be very worthy. You know, it's like, you know, the dad at the end of his career and the son, you know, and it's they're almost overwrought, a lot of those parts. Whereas, like, say, Noreen, the short that you did with Breen, I mean, it's just so funny, and absurdist is the word, really.
Yeah.
Do you have a very similar sense of humour, or is that the lad's sense of humour that you're kind of trying to tune into a little?
I don't have to tune in too hard now.
Yeah.
That was Donal's short. Donal wrote and directed that, and he has the most absurdist mind of us all, I think. But Brian has a sense of humour that, well, you'll say nothing for ages and then something will come out and you're saying, what was that? And so it's a much quieter, but it's equally daft at times. And it's like them all. Fergus is quick as a whippet. It's like when you have kids, it's one of the great joys of it is that they have all this utter difference and variety of approaches from the same place, the same nurturing, more or less, different place in the family, and they seem to, you know, it like the way their different takes on the world. So I just find it a constant joy, to be honest with you. They do make me laugh. There definitely is a kind of a shared thing, but then there's a whole lot of stuff that's very different, and that's they're the jewels where you're kind of saying, I've no idea how anybody could even think of that.
Yeah,
you know,
like,
so no, I just enjoy them.
Music is obviously a real passion of yours. Everyone would probably see that. We watched your documentary Farewell to Hughes's.
Oh yeah,
about the closing of the Trad Pub in Dublin from earlier in the year. We actually spoke to Rady Pete from Lancome about the cobblestone, how important that place has been to her, how important it is in the culture of the city. Can you chat to us a little bit about Hughes's and why that was such a special place for you?
Yeah, it was a great 30, 35 years of just a haven, really, for just a place to go and sit and listen and play a few tunes and not be bothered by anything else. It was a crazy sort of a pub anyway. And it's one thing I miss. Like, I don't go in. I'm kind of staying out of pubs now in terms of just, it just gets too much. You know, you feel like you're walking in as a bit of a feck sale, as Patrick O'Connor used to call it, as a, you know.
Is it just that your level of fame?
Well, it's just you've been on the telly, so somebody said, oh, geez, I'll get a photograph. And you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop all the time. Like, I realised over the last while, since Hughes has finished, actually, that you know, trying to put off the idea that you should be kind of in any way kind of a bit tensed up, trying to expect myself not to be, was unrealistic.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that anybody, like, people are lovely and, you know, but you're just kind of, you head out to the Jacks and somebody's waiting for you to go to the Jacks, and you realise then that you've been know that they're hanging around the Jacks up there waiting for you to go, and you're kind of saying that I've actually been a little bit on, I know that guy has been up there. I know he's waiting in the wings. It wasn't that he was going to ask anything bad, but it's just so apparent and it's a pain in the face and I'm not enjoying it anymore. So I decided not going in. Whereas with Hughes's, I was able to go in and feel I completely relaxed in it. The tunes were, like, I'm not a brilliant musician or anything. I tinker, like the way I tinker at a lot of stuff. I love it and I've tried to find out as much as I can from it. I don't practice enough any more than I did the football. And it's like, it just becomes something very deep and there's no conversation needed. You don't need to articulate anything other than just being in the moment. Like, it's such a difficult thing to be in the moment, isn't it? Like, you know, it's the whole secret to an awful lot, I think, just allowing yourself to be in the moment. And I think it's really difficult now with so many stimuli and all that. You know, and when you're acting, that's the whole thing, isn't it? It's about being in the moment and not trying to overly control or do it. Like, that just being there is the main thing, the main gift. But you come out and all of that has consequences and you come home from a pressurised situation, and I'd go into Hughes's and it was just you're among friends. This conversation where no articulation of anything is required other than the musical one, you know. Fabulous.
Yeah, and there's lovely shots of you playing in the pub, and this is after it's closed down, and you're just kind of lost in the music, you know, and like that's what you're talking about, just that level of just, I don't know, a flow state seems like a kind of an unnecessarily arsey phrase, but that's what
exactly, yeah. And I used to go away, and for a long time I used to sometimes bring a fiddle or not bring a fiddle, and I'm not that great in the fiddle anyway, because I just horsed at it any time I got a chance, and it used to take me out of what I was supposed to be doing when I was away, so it nearly, and then at some stage near the end of the run, I'd say, I must try and get myself a mandolin or something to be messing around on just to have some company. But a lot of the time, it was taking my head out of where I wanted to be. So when I came home and started learning the whole bloody thing again, so I just kind of felt, when I went in there, I could sink in. I just tried not to be in the way with the other musicians. And I didn't have an awful lot to give in terms of the expression of different things in the music. I just was hanging on my coattails a little bit. And these musicians are so good. But I became part of the flow in a way. I was granted access to it in a way I had no real right to be. And again, we're back to that community thing, that feeling of, yeah, being part of a communal feeling. Even it's not even a thought, just being there.
All right, Brendan, it's time to start earning some points here and having a tilt at the greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson title. And you can beat your own son in the process. So this is history to be made today. Tell us more about your Gaelic football career, aside from the John Timmins solo. Did you play at a more organised level? We've heard rumours of a glittering Gaelic football phase in St Finian's of Swords in your late 20s. What are your memories of that?
It was just mad. Mm. It was great fun. It was great crack. It was just brilliant. Like, it really was. Up around Fingal.
Hardy matches.
Oh, there were mad matches. I got married and we moved out to Swords, out to River Valley, and we were living there, and that started up from the half of the Aer Lingus GAA crowd. We're living there and decided to set up a club. So I said, that's the ideal opportunity for me to get to know people around. So I played with them for 6 or 7 years and was just...
Well, I did take the liberty of ringing some people in St Finian's just to, you know, make sure that everything checked out. And the euphemism that was used was that you were well able to look after yourself. That's a direct quote now from the executive committee of St Finian's of Swords.
I was a lover, not a fighter, right, for the most part. But there were a couple of incidents where... It was really funny. I remember hitting a fella in the face in Portmarnock entirely by accident, because he was hanging out of my jersey, and I swung back, and I had been a great advocate of fair play and not, you know, I never was into dirt really. And anyway, I swung back to free myself of the jersey and absolutely clocked him straight in the nose. And what I noticed after that was that I had an absolutely brilliant game.
Yeah. You'd earned the right to play, is what they call that.
Well, no, I frightened the poor fella. He was afraid to come near me. And it was a pure accident, I swear before anybody, that I didn't mean to do it. But I sort of said, all right, that's what it's about. That's what all the intimidation stuff is about. But no, I was always kind of torn between the two. I do remember one particular kind of a thing where we had started off in the Fingal League and we're kind of taking a soft touches in the first year or two. And we never used to group up as a whole bunch of players. We used to go up and try and break up a fight rather than join in. And we had the fortune or misfortune to have a hurler join us 1 week when we were short in numbers. And... he took an insult one too many off the opposition goalkeeper, who was huge. And this fellow was like a little burler. And he was walking away, and without breaking stride, he turned around and walked straight back and clocked your man in the face. And the guy went at him, and they were on the ground, and I was kind of holding people off. I was full forward, so I was first in there. And then I saw some other guy came over and drew a kick on the guy, and our guy on the ground, and that was enough for me. And we went in. But the whole team, anyway... kind of rolled off down the back of the hill. There was a hill behind. It was called River Valley because there was a river in a valley. And we went through the goal, and everybody's just a whole melee happened and went pouring, tumbling down the hill. And Mary brought Donald, 3 or 4 years old, to his first Gaelic match at that very same and came walking over the horizon and she said all she could see was my bum in the air. And it was like, she turned tail and went home, like, you know, without breaking stride. Yeah. And so it kind of put manners on people around the place where they said, okay, they will actually stand up. And I do find it very conflicting, the whole thing. I had no interest in fighting on a football pitch. I do see the need to stand up for yourself. And there is such a thing as being brave enough to stand up to yourself, which has to be lauded, I think. And it really was actually very good for me when I went acting. Because I said, this guy's trying to bully me here.
Right.
And I hate bullies. I really do. Always have.
When you say this guy, do you mean a director or a fellow actor on screen? Or
there was somebody was kind of intimating that if I didn't do something, that this is in this town, that I wouldn't work again. And I let it be known that I'd take him over across the desk if he ever actually articulated that. because I wasn't doing what he wanted. Or there were people over there when I went over first and they said, ah, no, no, this, you know, this isn't for you. And I kind of said, OK. And this, the lessons of sport of having to say, I don't actually like standing up for myself or having to. I'd much prefer to work along with people in whatever way we can do it. And if it's no good, it's no good. That's OK. But just the lessons of sport definitely helped me to stand my ground a little bit. So I'm grateful to it for that.
So Brennan was clearly a physical full forward, Murph.
Well, I mean, this is the 1980s, yeah. You know, so I think there's like a certain physicality that's required to play the...
And 1980s full forwards, I'm also thinking moustaches, pace, of course. Strictly over 10 metres.
Well, if I can just interject there, I was a good sprinter from the time I was a small child, and I ran for the school in Croker, which was, you know, a big claim to fame. I had a great sprint, and as long as it was 80 yards, I was grand. 100 yards... which turned into after you went into fifth or sixth class or something.
That way, 20 yards was
way too much for me. So I had a great sprint for about 5 yards, and then so I could get out in front as a full forward.
That's all you need as a full forward. You only need
that's
5 yards.
You need the first 5 yards were great. The problem was that my training wasn't the best. My training attitude wasn't the best. My training performance wasn't really very good. So full forward really was the only position because my fitness levels were... But I had an eye for goal if I didn't have to think about it. But I completely get, the little yips and all that. I kind of get that thing. If I overthink it, it's over.
Ah, this is all progressing very well. Before we rank your sporting life, we do need to know the pinnacle of your career. What's your highlight, Brendan? Presumably, it's got to be from your time as full forward with St Finian's.
Maybe you've gone up to North County Dublin and taken on a bunch of farmers and... Giving him hell. I've been up there myself, Brad. I've run that gauntlet. Don't worry.
I think the Finian's team of the decade participation. I was of the decade. Yeah. I suppose I don't know. Was it 10 years on or something like that? And they were celebrating or 20 years on from the club starting or something. Mm. And I was included in that couple of years after I left.
Okay, now that is legitimately big. No previous guest has made a team of the decade. Certainly not Brian anyway, let's face it. Let's put him out of his misery. Who will win the father and son battle? And can Brendan Gleeson set a big target on week one of the new series? Murph, could you now please rank this sporting life of Brendan Gleeson?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, I've overseen a lot of greatest Irish non-sportsperson adjudications, but bloody hell, I don't think I've ever experienced anything like this. Father against son, Gleeson against Gleeson. And all that's up for grabs, really, is the possible continuation, or indeed, irreversible overthrow of the power dynamics of Irish acting's most famous family. So to remind you all, Brian Gleeson scored 74 points across the range of categories under consideration. These include assessing your all-time sporting highlight, Brendan, picking an athlete that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then giving you a score out of 100. Your unblemished record of high achievement with St Finian's of sorts stands the test of time. And in fact, as I've said, having spoken to members of the committee over there in the last few days, I can reveal that you are immortalised in plaque form on the clubhouse wall as being a part of their first ever football team to represent the club in 1983. And we need to remember that your time at number 14 was springtime for the burly full forward, with your fellow dub Joe McNally firing the 12 apostles to glory in 1983. But the gold standard for the bear on the square remains Owen Bomber Liston, who combined a barrel chest with the softest of hands, the most educated of boots, and the shortest of tempers, much like our guest here today. But we come now to the crux of the matter. Fatherhood is about passing on the lessons learned throughout your own life. You forced your eldest son, Donald, to be an Aston Villa fan, and after 40 short years of boredom, depression, and awful football, he finally gets his rewards with a Champions League spot for next season. That sort of foresight earns big points. But what's best for Breen here? Should we adopt the everyone's a winner philosophy now rampant in underage sport? Would we be doing Breen a favour if we were to say Mullinoiga agus Chucky Sheed? Well, on this show, there are no participation medals. The plain fact of the matter is that you have a far superior sporting career to Breen. You beat him on every possible metric.
Oh, no.
You pummel him, in fact. And it's a crushing victory for Gleeson Pear. with 83 points. Oh, Brendan Gleeson, this has been your sporting life.
I'm mixed emotions.
Well, listen, as a small thank you for coming in today, we want to present you with a little present. We didn't have Goal magazine that you mentioned earlier, but yeah, we have got you an original copy of Match magazine All-Star Football Special from 1982, the last time your beloved Villa were league champions. It features Villa's Gordon Cowans there on the cover. There's a fact file inside with Villa star Tony Morley. Favourite pre-match meal, sugar puffs. Favourite drink, lager shandy. Like very, he's very 1982.
There's
a cut out and keep poster of the striker Peter with as well. Listen, all the pages are handily marked there by our production team, as you can see. So you've been absolutely amazing. It's been such an honour. A round of applause for Brendan Gleeson.
Thanks very much.
Thundering is magic, and if there's a better way to live, I gotta have it. Because I think all day, but when I drink, I'm okay. Gets further away every time I try grab it. Underneath all the chatter in this heaven, got a little peak one day, made me feel like I was seven. I know it exists, but I can't stop getting pissed. One more thing, I'll be added to the list.
How good is that tune? Better Way to Live from Kneecap with Green Chat. And Kneecap are having a major moment right now internationally with the cinema release on the way of their movie starring Michael Fassbender, no less. And our guest next week, I'm delighted to say, is Mowgli Bapp from Kneecap. Very funny guy, fascinating background. He's got a great story. But forget about him for now. What about Brendan Gleeson? Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, he might never have perfected the John Timmons solo, but what a career. And just such great company in person. Yeah. Like you're saying, Murph, the laugh is just amazing. I hope that really comes across to everyone listening. It's so infectious when you're in there.
I'm still a little starstruck, Owen. I may be starstruck for the rest of the weekend.
No, I know. Yeah, me too. Like, we can admit that now.
Yeah, what a presence.
Absolutely, great to have him in for the opening show. We'll be back same time, same place next week. This has been a Second Captain's production for RTÉ Radio 1. Killian Down produced. Thanks so much to Johnny Lanagan in RTÉ. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captain's. Thank you, Murph.
Thanks a million, Owen.
Saturday Sport is coming right up. You can listen to the Second Captain's podcast right through the week. Join us on Monday on secondcaptains.com for all the reaction to tomorrow's All-Ireland Hurling Final. And we are going to play out the show today with something a little special to get you in the mood for Cork against Clare. We leave you now with the sounds of the gloaming and the dulcet tones of one of our favourite Second Captain's guests, Theo Dorgan, reciting his wonderful poem, All-Ireland Final. Enjoy.
We stand for the anthem, buoyant and tribal, heart beating with heart, our colours brave, our faces turned towards the uncertain sun. The man beside me takes my hand. Good luck to yours, he says. I squeeze his calloused palm and then he's gone. A shadow socket where he was. The one beside him vanishes and another before me. All around Croke Park, one by one, we wink out of existence. Tens, hundreds, then thousands. The great arena emptying out. The wind curling in from the open world to gather us all away. Each single one of us. I could feel myself fail at the end, but then maybe everyone thought that, each single one of us the last to go. The whistle blew and we all came back with a roar, everything brighter and louder, desperate and vivid. I held his hand a moment longer. I wished his team all the luck in the world.